Well, welcome. Welcome to this, our 61st show, 61st program with Palestine Deep Dive. Sorry for the slight delay, everybody, but we're delighted to be joined this evening by Dr. Iman Saka and Dr. Hamdan Taha. And I believe that Hamdan is in Ramallah in Palestine and Imam is in Chicago. Welcome to you both. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
We're going to be having a very interesting discussion this evening. This is an issue that is dear to a lot of people's hearts, but very rarely does it get the proper kind of deep dive discussion that it merits. The role of archaeology, the role of culture, the role of the expropriation of archaeology and culture. These are all of the things we want to talk about this evening, and we're very keen to hear from all of you. So do send in your questions. And we do so in a week, of course, where in the UK, where I am, we've just had the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II. And her funeral, which, of course, has been a huge global event in a way. Lots of people have been seeing what's been happening in this country this week. But it's also opened up a whole series of other debates, not least here, too, about cultural expropriation, if you like, the borrowing, the stealing sometimes, the buying of things from other parts of the world, from the Koh-i-Noor diamond in the imperial crown to the Benin bronzes in Nigeria, to the Elgin marbles, of course, from Athens in Greece. These are all very powerful issues, but these also are issues that relate very much to Palestine. And we're going to be talking about those today because the material evidence of history should be straightforward, but we have been witnessing a remarkable degree of cultural appropriation and often an attempt to make history fit a narrative. So I should introduce our wonderful guests. And well, first of all, I should just say I'm Mark Seddon. I used to be a correspondent for Al Jazeera when Al Jazeera was first set up. I was their UN correspondent and I subsequently went to work for the United Nations. I was a speechwriter for the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, and I worked for the President of the General Assembly. And I spent a lot of time as a journalist in the Middle East and also working for the United Nations in the Middle East. Dr. Hamdan Taha, welcome. Yeah. I'll just let people know more about you. Of course, many of you will know about Hamdan, but though for those who don't, Hamdan is a former Deputy Minister for Tourism and Antiquities and served between 1994 and 2004 as the Director General of the newly established Department of Antiquities in Palestine. He directed a series of excavations and restoration projects. He also worked as a national coordinator for the World Heritage Programme in Palestine. Hamdan is the author of many books, field reports, and scholarly articles, and he's currently the coordinator of the Palestine History and Heritage Project, for which he has co-authored an introductory volume, A New Critical Approach to the History of Palestine, with his co-author Ingrid Hegelm. I hope I've got her pronunciation right there. Thomas Thompson and Ilan Pape. Ilan, of course, is a frequent guest on this show. He authored a chapter, Excavating Earth and Memory, in the book Our Vision for Liberation, which is, of course, edited by another friend of Palestine Deep Dive, Ramzi Barood. So welcome, Hamdan, and welcome, Iman. Iman is a professor of anthropology and archaeology and chair of the Department of Sociology, Anthropology and Criminal Justice at the St. Xavier University of Chicago in the United States, where she is this evening. She also holds the position of Director of the Middle Eastern Studies Program at the university, and her work focuses on the archaeology of the Near East, heritage, education, and preservation, oral history, and local communities' involvement in heritage. And Dr. Saka was involved in the successful nomination to the UNESCO World Heritage List of the archaeological site of Al Zubara in Qatar, and she was also involved in the nomination of the village of Batir, Palestine, to the UNESCO World Heritage List. She's presented and given talks at numerous national and international conferences, and she's also been involved in numerous excavations. She's published several articles and written a book on the art of Palestinian embroidery. Well, fascinating. What a remarkable backgrounds you both have. And it's very special to have you with us this evening. I'm just going to begin, if I may. And I think really this is perhaps this is a question for you, Iman, because this week has seen a kind of a quite remarkable discovery, which kind of lifted us. It was all this depressing talk about President Putin and nuclear weapons and more conflict in Ukraine and the Queen Elizabeth's funeral, but some Byzantine light was thrown on everything by this discovery, this fantastic mosaic in Gaza. Absolutely brilliant. The colors just cut through. Here we have a picture here of a Gaza farmer. He found this Byzantine mosaic while planting a tree. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, and it's an olive tree for all. So it's a really wonderful story, and a story of a farmer taking initiative. And instead of covering up and being worried about finding archaeology in his land, actually brought in the people in charge, the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquity and the Department of Archaeology, and told them about the site, which is a wonderful, wonderful attitude to have from that farmer. Because as we're going to talk maybe a little bit later, there's always a fear of finding archaeology on your land. So it is absolutely wonderful what this farmer Suleiman Nabhanin did. The ministry sent in archaeologists, the Department of Archaeology. Archaeologists went in, tried to preserve and expose this amazing mosaic, which is Byzantine, as you said. It is. It has beautiful framed images of animals. I think as of today, there's like 18 of them, of showing the diversity of these beautiful animals. There's also images of social life. They also found pottery and glass. So that's absolutely wonderful. And they're still opening up parts of the site. What the ministry did, it was to claim the land from the farmer and compensate him. So I think they're working out a compensation right now for the farmer for the land. So there is an exposing of the site, and it's absolutely beautiful. And we should keep up with the news.
Is it likely to be much larger, a much larger site, that more to find, do you think?
I think so. And there's talk about, well, people don't know if it's part of a temple or part of a church or part of a Byzantine church or part of a house complex. So it's yet not clear what it is. And I think they're looking into that. So yes, there's a potential of it being much larger. And I think a French archaeologist were also brought in to kind of assist the local archaeologist, Palestinian archaeologist, were kind of working on that. So it's absolutely a wonderful discovery, and everyone hopefully should keep their eye on it. And it's a wonderful example of preserving or wanting to preserve this unique find. I think it's a good news.
Yes, and a rare sort of glint of light, a rare piece of good news from Gaza. But I suppose in passing, we have to say that, the idea that we're going to be able to see it, all of us from outside, is pretty remote. They don't let people in, and they don't let people out of Gaza, as we know.
I know. It's going to be hard to go in, absolutely. But I'm hoping that they will put it beautifully on the web for us all to see. But it's a shame that we're not going to be able to personally go in. And I have to admit, not even Palestinians from the West Bank are going to be able to go in and see it as well.
Well, actually, yes, Iman, just the other week we had a guest who was telling us, because people do tend to forget, she said one of her great dreams of being a resident of Gaza was one day to go to Jerusalem. Well, one day to go to Ramallah, one day. And people were saying, well, why can't you? Well, we know why. You can't move unless you're allowed with special permission, different parts of the Palestinian territories.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add that people see Gaza for what it is today. It's a difficult place to live. There's some serious restrictions on the people, some serious occupation. But I always want people to remember that Gaza had more than 4,000 years of history. And all this history is in Gaza, still underground. Some of it sadly destroyed, but other is still protected. So there's a depth of history in Gaza that I think we should definitely start celebrating a little bit more.
Well, look, thank you very much, Iman. I mean, we're going to get into a further deep dive, but before we do, I'm going to turn to you, Hamdan, because you know, when it comes to archaeology, it's much more straightforward if something like this is discovered in Gaza. But where there's been real contention, of course, and a lot of people will have seen this, has been underneath the Temple Mount. The archaeology, the digging, the work that's gone on there. I mean, I think it was there's been archaeological work going on there for about 150 odd years, and I think I'm right in saying that there was a British Royal Engineers detachment that was actually digging down back in the 1860s. But since Israel took control of that site in 1967, it's been heavily politicized, and archaeological digs and archaeological work, historical work, has become deeply politicized. Could you just give us a very brief overview of what is happening? Why is there a dispute about essential real history? What is there to dispute about real things that are found?
Good evening. I would like to thank you, Mark, for having me with Dr. Iman. Unfortunately, this archaeology has been turned to a battleground, although I believe that the problem doesn't lay in the past or in the nature of archaeological evidences itself. It is part of an integral history. And I think it is how past should be viewed as an integral whole. And I think with the idea of dividing history comes problems. And I think here ideological criteria are set to view the past, and that is the problem going on now. Israeli excavation carried out in the old city in Jerusalem following the occupation of the city in 1967 were carried out by Antiquities Authority, academic institution, also sponsored by religious institution for a clear ideological agenda. It has been described even by prominent Israeli archaeologist Raphael Greenberg, for example, as using a brutal method, imposing ideological agenda bluntly. And as well as lacking standard scientific criteria also in conducting these excavations. And at the same time, excavations were all used as places for open discussion, interaction and the debate between scientists and archaeologists, while these excavations are carried out secretly and without being open to the public. So I think that is part of the scene. Also what we have what have been shown also by...
Can I just come in there? Because what I was quite interested to discover was that essentially archaeological work is being conducted under the authority of different organizations. I think...
Exactly. I mean,
I'm touching on that. The Israelis, they've got an archaeological investigation group. But also, I think, as a joint Jordanian-Palestinian archaeological team, too. So do these two teams communicate, or is there, I mean, what we see from some, actually, we may have some footage, actually, of a former United States envoy getting involved. Not, this is not underneath the Temple Mount, but I think at Silwan, but essentially involved in a sort of politicization process of archaeology. I don't know if we can have a quick look at that video of the special envoy David Friedman. Yeah, I mean, Hamdan, may you give a little explanation to us of what was going on there?
I think this is an illustrative example of how ideology make people out of sense completely. Mm-hmm. And what we saw is an example of that in a way. That people were looking for certain layers and do not see the integral history of the city. Jerusalem history is composed of different cultures, layers, and therefore it should be understood as an integral whole. I think bringing the history to a certain moment in the past can confuse chaos and will not help in getting a better understanding of the past and future. Therefore, I would say that what is going on in Jerusalem, starting from destruction of the Moroccan quarter and the Sharf quarter following the occupation of the city in 1967, and further excavation inside the city walls and also in the neighboring quarter, including Silwan, is an example of ideological enterprise to create history and to establish a narrative on the ruins of real history. And this is what we see. Archaeological remains are demolished and even bulldozed and erased in the inside the city. Also in Bab el-Khalil, it has been bulldozed. And in the cemetery of Mamella, interlinked with the history of the city, it has been completely demolished. I think the Israeli excavation in Jerusalem set an example for ideological work and work motivated by ideological motivation to establish a linkage between the past and the present settler in the city, and undermining the history of the indigenous population in Jerusalem and also in the surrounding neighborhood as Silwan.
So Hamdan, what you're saying is effectively it's kind of making history exclusive. You publicize that bits of it that you want that are helpful to your narrative, I suppose.
Exactly. But
we've had a couple of people getting in touch. Jenny in Liverpool says, thank you both very much for this important discussion. I've always been appalled to hear about how Israel appropriates archaeology to steal more land from Palestinians. So I look forward to learning more in the show. Now, here's a question. This wasn't wasn't one actually, but I mean, I'm going to come to you, Iman. It wasn't one I was going to ask, but I'm sure you're very qualified to answer it. Graham in London asks, he says, who is worst? Is it the British or the Israelis when it comes to the colonization of Palestine through archaeology? You make that distinction. Who are the worst, the British or the Israelis? Or both as bad as each other?
Wow. Well, one, I think, supported the other in a way. I think historically speaking, Palestine in general has been excavated through different lenses and for different purposes. So I think we can think of archaeology conducted in the land of Palestine for imperial colonial reasons, for biblical reasons, and for political ideological reasons. So I think we see that present in the land of Palestine. So I think there's a deep history there. So I think the British came in and wanted to, I mean, there was a competition with the French, don't forget that, after the Sykes-Picot agreement on getting as much information out of Palestine as possible. And the British have established the Palestine Exploration Fund. And from there has been a lot of projects trying to document the sites in Palestine, but the focus was really on, became on biblical sites later on. So biblical sites became the main reason for doing a lot of these archaeological excavations. And as one, some archaeologists said that basically the purpose of doing archaeology was to give accuracy to biblical narratives. So that's kind of what was happening under the British, and then that was carried on under the Israelis for their own agenda. As Dr. Hamdan said, there are different agendas and different people trying to tell their story. So that was picked up, and I think there was an idea of the state of Israel trying to figure out a narrative that will help it establish nationhood, support its colonial ideology, and the creation of historical knowledge in Palestine. So they basically started doing excavations that were geared into that. So I think both of them really used archaeology for a variety of reasons. And then the Israelis have built a lot on the biblical archaeology that was started by the British and continued.
Yes, I mean, is there an attempt to actually downgrade or just or ignore or yes, well, that's downgrade's a good word, actually, to say, well yes, of course, you know, there are all sorts of other civilizations represented through the great history of this part of the world, but ours is preeminent. The rest are pretty primitive. Because one example suddenly springs to my mind, which was the great ruins of Zimbabwe.
Yes.
When that country, you'll recall this, was called Rhodesia, the settlers there claimed that the great ruins of Zimbabwe were not built by black
indigenous
people. They were built by white people. They discovered a completely new race of people, actually, these white settlers in Rhodesia. But that's what they claimed. That was a really quite grotesque kind of racist appropriation of history. So do you see the same demand with all of this? Something similar?
To tell you the truth, I do see similarities, of course. I do see similarity where the indigenous population don't have a place in the narrative that the Israeli state is trying to push forth. And it started early on with their excavations in the 60s in Masada. Basically, the narrative was one, and it focused on a specific time period that supported the narrative. And I think the locals do not have a space in that narrative that's been told. And I do see a linkage with what happened in Zimbabwe and other places. And for in Palestine, it still continues until today, where the local narrative does not necessarily have a place. in the bigger picture, especially in areas as contested, like Dr. Hamdan says, as Jerusalem and other areas. So that there's a clear erasure of any time period that existed except for that one period with a focus on it. So, yes.
Thank you. Hamdan, coming to you, I mean, are there examples in recent history where certain archaeological sites have been destroyed or buried because they're a bit inconvenient, because they don't fit a narrative? And over a longer period, I suppose, this is a slightly separate question, but has there been a history in Palestine of stealing antiquities from whoever has been occupying the land at any given time? Archaeological destruction is my question, I suppose, over history.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was associated with the history of Palestine, theft and illicit trafficking, as well as the appropriation of archaeological finds. At the end of the Ottoman period, there was no archaeological legislation to protect archaeological heritage. Probably the first edict was in 1869, and it set a framework for protection of archaeological finds amid a very fierce competition between colonial power about the acquisition of archaeological artifacts and also sites, even archaeological sites. However, was linked with the early archaeological campaign excavation. Archaeological artifacts were taken out of the country, and it was filling stores and also shelves of European and American museum. And therefore, it is all over the world now. And I think this is one of the main challenges facing archaeologists also in understanding this episode. However, that was part of the colonial practice, including special focus on certain sites, certain period, certain layer, and also a neglection of certain other layers. For example, the cultural periods belonging to the early Arab period, Umayyad, Abbasid. That was not even in the first excavation, it was not even recorded. And I think that is examples of how archaeology has been used as a tool, as an ideological tool to enforce certain narrative, I would say exclusive narrative, versus a potential inclusive narrative which should reveal.
Thank you. There's a question here. This is from Lindsay in New York, and she asks, has the Zionist movement always used archaeology to justify its colonization, or is it a more recent phenomenon? Iman, is that something that you could talk to?
Yeah, but Dr. Hamdan started answering that line of questions.
I'll give him a chance. I'll stay with you on this then. What would you say to Lindsay in New York?
Yeah, I would say yes. It has been used as an instrument to justify Zionist colonial project in Palestine. heavily. And therefore, archaeological claims on the land has been justified using archaeological evidences, artifacts, to lay these claims. And we also see how archaeological sites has been chosen in order to justify these political claims. Names of sites has been changed also, and indigenous and authentic names, historical names has been changed with biblical names in order to fit the political narrative.
And if you want me to add, I can add to that by saying that this religious national ideology have always existed because of that narrative of the, you know, we've been there for a long time, we were exiled and we're coming back. So that's the Zionist narrative. And to prove that narrative, archaeology has played a very important role in coming in and finding the sites that shows the earlier presence and this continuity with a short period of exile. So that's so yes, as Dr. Hamdan said, archaeology played a very important role in this national religious ideology.
Well, John Sharkey says he's got in touch. John says this is of course identical to what has and is happening to Indigenous peoples in Canada and other places around the world. I mean, if we could just stay with this topic for just a little bit longer before we move on, and coming to you, Iman, if I may, here's a question. After the establishment of the State of Israel, how has Israel prioritised? I mean, we have touched on this partially so far, but how has it prioritised what is called biblical archaeology? We have talked about that.
Yeah.
But could you explain to people who are watching, what is this concept of stratigraphy? Stratigraphy, that's the archaeological layers in the ground.
Yes, it is.
Can you tell us what that's all about?
That's the only way archaeology should be and could be done and must be done. It is digging layers of the earth and going down stratigraphically from the earlier to the later layers. And in archaeology, each layer is extremely important and should not be ignored. So if you want a layer on the bottom here, you should not hastily dig through all these other layers in order to get to the period that you want. And this is not good archaeology. It's not scientific archaeology. And it's archaeology that ignores all others that came before that period that you are interested in. And that has applied to many sites that were excavated by Israeli archaeologists earlier on, where a lot of these layers, the stratigraphic layers, were hastily removed. Different periods were not well documented. Dr. Hamdan mentioned the Arab period, but these were hastily removed. And the focus was on a specific time period, mainly the Iron Age, where it talked about the stories of King Solomon and King David. And that was the main purpose of doing excavations. And the way I just mentioned it, it's not only in the past, in early Israeli archaeology, but we see it in the present as well, in some sites that are being excavated. So I'll come back to one of those sites in later discussion, but that's a story that is continuing until today. So getting to the strata, the layer that tells your story, is what has been done by Israeli archaeologists for a long time. And this is well documented by other Israeli archaeologists. Going to that layer that tells that specific story.
It's almost, as you're saying this, I'm thinking it's almost as though here in Britain, in England, there's a desire to get to some Anglo-Saxon archaeology, but they know they've got to cut through a Roman mosaic to get there, and they do it because that's all they're interested in. That's the danger here, isn't it? That essentially there's a lot of there's destruction that takes place in this rush.
And I have to admit, I'm sad to admit that archaeology is destruction at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But as a science, it's organized, clear, well-documented destruction. So in order to get to the lower layers, you have to remove the upper layers. But you have to clearly document them, well document them. And sometimes you have to stop because what you're finding is magnificent regarding the layers before and moving maybe your excavation to another part of the site.
And of course, we forget, but in terms of historic Palestine, this is a comparatively small area of the Middle East. And yet there's this intense history over millennia that is there. Very crowded, but I'll just stay with you for one more question, Iman, before I move back to Dr. Hamdan, which is that, you know, did the Oslo Accords make any difference? Did this enable archaeology in some of the new Palestinian designated Palestine Authority areas? Did it mean that you had a greater power to do the work that you wanted to?
You know, I think that's a really long discussion that we should definitely talk about again in this interview. But the Oslo Accord were an important step in solidifying the work that Palestinians were doing. And I think that's extremely important. So this is the first chance where Palestinians had the opportunity to actually excavate in Palestine. And when I say in Palestine, I mean specifically the West Bank and Gaza, and not all of the West Bank and Gaza, might I add, because according to the Oslo Agreement, the West Bank and Gaza were divided into areas A, B, and C, where areas A were under Palestinian complete civil and military control. B is under civil control for the Palestinians only, but Israeli military control. And area C was completely under the control of the Israelis, which is almost 61, if not more, percent of the total of the West Bank we're talking. So like you said, it's a small territory, but at the end of the day, that small territory is even divided in chunks. And these chunks have been, a big chunk was taken out of these smaller chunks and put under Israeli control. Mm-hmm. So yes, in area, and please let's come back to that question again, but area A and B, Palestinian have control at the moment in order to protect and preserve the and document the archaeological sites in those areas. And sadly, there has not been a lot of ability to do work in area C that is under Israeli control. And a lot of sites were destroyed. A lot of sites have not been well documented. And illegal excavations by the Israeli government is taking place in those areas where under international law, there should not be.
What does UNESCO have to say about that?
Dr. Hamdan, what do they have to say about this?
Yeah. excavation in occupied territories is prohibited simply according to the international humanitarian law, according to Hague Convention, as well as UNESCO Convention. The only form of archaeological excavation allowed by occupying authorities is salvage operation, which is a mandatory task when excavating to build roads or military bases. That is the only form of excavation allowed. Otherwise, the excavation carried out in the Palestinian area since 1967 is a grave violation of the international law. And hundreds of excavation has been so far carried out by Israeli authorities. And therefore, it has been one of the issues of interim agreement, and UNESCO has repeatedly condemned excavation in Palestinian areas, as well as in Jerusalem in particular, as it is viewed as occupied territories.
And actually, we have got a question. This is from Jamal in Toronto in Canada. And he asks, well, what impact did the construction of what is known as the apartheid wall have on archaeology? Because, I mean, you know, you look at that, you see it snaking through territory, presumably going over some archaeological sites, Dr. Hamdan.
Exactly. hundreds of archaeological sites has been affected by this wall, which is built to grab land, in fact, and cultural resources as well. About 50% of archaeological sites has been encircled inside this wall, and also in the line of the of the wall itself, many sites has been demolished and erased for this for building this wall. However, I think the wall is built inside the Palestinian areas as well, and it is not built on the at least on the green line, which which is regarded as an international border between the Palestinian occupied territories and Israel.
So I'll tell you what, I'm going to move on to this issue of the comparative resources available to Israeli archaeologists and to Palestinian archaeologists. I'm not really sure whether this is a question for you, Iman, or a question for you, Hamdan. But I mean, there must be a very, very clear imbalance. The result, because archaeology, of course, is, I mean, you don't have to be an archaeologist to know that it's hugely expensive. You've got to have a lot of resources. And also, what to do with all of this wonderful material once you find it. You have to put it into a museum, and you have to build museums, and you have to put galleries and all of these things. So in terms of, is that for you, Iman? Could you tell us about the comparative financing of archaeological work in between Israel and Palestine?
I can talk about one part of it, and maybe Dr. Hamdan can jump in and talk about the other part. The one part that I would like to talk about is the Israeli part, because there's a lot of funding for archaeological sites. And when the government of Israel is unable to fund through their government offices, a lot of funding comes from outside. So let me just share with you that there's a group, and we already talked about Silwan, so I'm not going to talk about it, but I do want to say that there's a group called Elad that is funding. It's a private settler organization. That's how they define themselves. And they are actually pouring a lot of money and funding excavations that are happening in Jerusalem. And very recently, they kind of worked with the Jewish National Fund to even get more funding to do more excavations in Jerusalem area. So even when the Israeli government and they're basically the archaeology departments locally don't have a lot of money, groups like this private settler group are, thank you for putting the image on there. Elad is just one example, but they have been very prominent in funding large scale excavations, paying a lot of money to have this work not only done, but done very, very quickly. And and so that's that on this side. And on the other side, Dr. Hamdan.
Yeah, I think funds are limited, provided by the Palestinian government to the Department of Antiquities. It covers salaries and basic needs for protection and salvage excavation. The mega project has been carried out since the Oslo Agreement in the Palestinian areas were largely carried out as joint projects in cooperation with European and American universities. Mm-hmm. And the first joint operation was carried out at Tel Sultan, ancient Jericho, with the University of Rome, La Sapienza. And so far, 14 campaign has been conducted in this site, and it has turned these are neglected archaeological sites to archaeological park. Other examples were carried out jointly at Tel Balata and Khirbet Balama with the Dutch universities as well. And it was also exemplary in excavating, revealing the history of these sites and also rehabilitating these sites as archaeological park. For the sake of local communities and mm-hmm. also contributing in maximizing tourism in these areas. Other example were carried out at Tisham's Palace jointly with the University of Chicago, and also other example of joint cooperation were carried out in Gaza with French also institutions. I think this formula of cooperation was effective and fruitful. It is based on joint partnership, joint cooperation, where Palestinians are contributing with local coordination, as well as logistical also help, while the international partner are contributing with their expertise and field budget also in the field.
I'm just thinking, Dr. Hamdan, about youngsters, the young people growing up in Israel, Palestine, who maybe are getting a very one-sided view of history, of culture, of their region, because there is this expropriation going on. There's this definition of what is important and what isn't, what should be learned and what perhaps shouldn't. How do you take this away from the politics? So to enable young people, whether they be Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or none of the above, to actually get a full understanding of the rich history of historic Palestine?
Yeah, I think Palestine has a great history, stretching from prehistoric time to the present. It has a diverse culture for over million years, and this diversity is a value by itself. And I think it is, as described by German geographer, as a small continent. Therefore, I would say that these values should be preserved. It is,
There's a Byzantine cell phone going off there, I think, Dr. Hamdan.
Yeah. Yeah, it, I think it is all the, these values should be preserved, and therefore, I think it is an opportunity for cooperation to preserve this human heritage as well. And I hope that in the future, where we hope to see a peaceful settlement, this will enable more cooperation. And I believe that this is possible, and based on mutual interest and respect as well.
And one final question for you, Dr. Hamdan, in this part of the prep, we're going to extend it slightly if you've both got time to stay with us, because if that's all right with you, we've got a lot of interest, and we're getting quite a few people getting in touch. One person is Mick. Mick is in Cornwall, in England, and he asks, are there UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Palestine, and are Palestinians allowed to visit them, or does the Israeli occupation stop them? That's for you, Hamdan.
Well, I think it is, there is so far three sites inscribed on the World Heritage List following admitting Palestine as a full member in the UNESCO, and also adopting the World Heritage Convention in 2011. Bethlehem was inscribed in 2012. The cultural landscape of Batir, southern Jerusalem mountains, have been also inscribed in 2014. And the old town of Hebron was inscribed in 2017. And currently there is a nomination file for Jericho underway. I think these sites are open, and people who can get to Palestine, it is possible to visit these sites and enjoy this experience.
Dr. Iman, we began the show actually by talking about this remarkable and wonderful discovery this week of these Byzantine mosaics in Gaza. But of course, you know, in areas where there's conflict and war and bombings, we see this all the time. Ancient sites being destroyed. There's a lot of fear in Ukraine now that some of the very old Orthodox churches are going to be damaged. Wherever there's war, there's damage to historical sites. And let's say, for the sake of argument, that one of these very heavy bombs been dropped on where these mosaics have been discovered, we may never have even heard of them or seen them. So how do you think that the bombing, the intensity of the bombing that's happened in Gaza over recent years, could have damaged archaeological sites or risked them? Is that something you're able to reflect on at all?
The quick answer is yes. There has been destruction to archaeological sites because of bombing that has happened in Gaza. And for other reasons as well, but bombing has been an issue. Targeted or non-targeted, there has been destruction to sites. And there are other destructions that we have to be very careful with, which is city is confined in space. There's no possibility of expansion. So building project, even Palestinian building projects, have to be very aware of the land that they are building on. But it's very difficult because there's just no space anymore in Gaza for anyone to expand. But in terms of war, yes. And war also brings in lack of resources for protection of sites. And that's another issue that the Palestinians have to deal with. These are some of the realities on the ground of having to deal with lack of funds to preserve some of these sites as well.
You see, Dr. Miniman, I was just, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, given the enormous pressure on Palestinian budgets, the daily struggles of life in Gaza, which we've documented over the past year or so here with many of our guests who have told us about how they live or exist very often in places like Gaza, you know, people might think, well, archaeology is hardly going to be top of any priority list. So, you know, what is the situation now? I guess the question, I suppose, is, you know, are there many trained Palestinian archaeologists? Is there time and energy and commitment for this?
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to answer the first part about Gaza and then talk about the personnel. Gazans are fabulous. They're amazing and they're steadfast and they're so strong. And it's fascinating the things that they're able to do under such difficult circumstances. The reason I'm saying that is they have done a few amazing projects, renovating old houses, architecturally speaking, turning them into small museums. So while they are surviving, barely surviving in Gaza, they have not forgotten to preserve the cultural heritage of Gaza. So we see amazing examples of preserving sites, archaeological sites, but also of not only government, but or smaller organizations, neighborhood, working architects working together to preserve the heritage of Gaza. It is absolutely wonderful. And there's an article I just read a week ago in Al Monitor that talks about the effort of documenting the various sites in Gaza. So creating a catalog of the sites, not only archaeological sites, but architectural sites. So with all this difficulty, the people of Gaza are really pushing hard towards preserving their heritage. They're not forgetting about that. So that's wonderful. And to briefly answer the second part, and Dr. Hamdan can add to that, there are Palestinian archaeologists today that have studied in Palestine or abroad. We have a good number of PhDs that are willing and able and are working in the field. And we have universities that are offering archaeology program with the limited resources that they have.
Oh, that's fantastic. Have you got anything that you'd like to add to that, Dr. Hamdan?
Yeah, I think Palestinian archaeologists are attending now to their duties in preserving their archaeological heritage, as well as also participating in writing a historical narrative, an inclusive historical narrative, which represent all voices, religious creeds, as well as ethnic groups, showing the diverse culture of Palestine.
And we did actually, just before we got deep down into this particular subject, we did have a quick photo. We had a quick picture of the of that front page headline. I think it was in UN News about Palestine being admitted into UNESCO. So, Dr. Hamdan, does membership of UNESCO actually, is it helpful? Does it help you in your work? Does it give you a feeling of greater confidence in what you're doing?
Very much. I think this partnership with UNESCO contributed very much in defending Palestinian rights, and also empowering Palestinian institution as well as personnel to in respect to building a World Heritage Program in Palestine, training people also how to contribute in management of archaeological sites, as well as also contributing in familiarization with the international convention as well. And I think this contribution of UNESCO and UN agencies was vital for Palestinian in safeguarding the rich archaeological heritage of Palestine, including also building the human and institutional capacities of Palestinian archaeological institutions.
And if you don't mind me, I'd like to add something to what Dr. Hamdan just said, which is, you know, now that the Palestine is a full member of UNESCO since 2011, we can also document under international law, under the Hague and the Fourth Geneva Convention, all of the trespassing that Israel has been doing in Area C. So at least we're able to document officially and legally, but officially under the umbrella of UN and UNESCO, the trespasses that have been happened, especially in areas C, where there's a lot of that going on. So I think UNESCO is an important body, and it helped protect it helps protect these archaeological sites. And I just want to say to the gentleman that asked about these UNESCO sites, the reason we can go visit them is they are in area A and B. Yes. So they are in Palestinian territory.
Well, actually, Dr. Iman, your answer there is partly, I think, answered the question that came from Sama in Florida, because she wanted to know, how can Palestinians reclaim their archaeology and the truth about what lies in the ground, just as Palestinians around the world seem to be currently reclaiming the narrative? Well, getting there to see for yourselves has got to be really part and parcel of it, like understand and appreciate. I suppose we have to sadly bring things to an end, but before we do, I'm going to put this to both of you, because, you know, we live in times where we have a much more immediate access to information and opinion. We can learn what's happening in different parts of the world and that news goes around the world in minutes. But there's also a time when very often people are retreating into silos of like-minded souls, if you like-minded friends, allies, whatever you like to call it. Particularly in the case of Israel-Palestine, people get into these bunkers. And if you have cultural appropriation or a view of history which shows that there's one bit of archaeology that matters or one bit of history that matters more than others, or you're only going to be exclusive in what you teach, it means that these silos become even more intense and people just don't learn about each other's histories and cultures. And yet we know about Palestine and this great history stretching all the way back. So Dr. Hamdan, Dr. Iman, how can archaeology bring people together? For you, first of all, Dr. Hamdan, how can archaeology bring people together?
Yeah. I believe that
because Liam in Denver just said, because tie this into your answer if you can, because it is a question we did want to ask, but does community archaeology play a role in all of that as well, bringing people together?
I think archaeology can show and enforce and enhance cultural understanding between people. I would say that using archaeology as a tool will not help fostering this idea of shared heritage. In contrary, I believe that writing an inclusive historical narrative presenting voices of all people would play a role in in understanding between people, nations, and also make a shared values and understanding between people.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hamdan. And to you, finally, Dr. Iman.
This is a difficult question and a bit of a complicated one. I think historically, Palestinians have not been permitted to participate in the archaeological endeavor. I grew up in Palestine, and there was no archaeology. We couldn't study it. And archaeology is opening up right now to many young archaeologists in Palestine. So I think it's important that a Palestinian archaeologist, young Palestinians, learn about archaeology in a more inclusive way. It's hard because of what the other side has been, how it has been using archaeology. But it's important to remind people that archaeology in Palestine specifically is the history of the many civilizations that has passed through this land over many, many years. And I think that's an important history to highlight. And you can do that archaeologically because we have all different kinds of sites in Palestine. And we can do that through writing, as Dr. Hamdan earlier mentioned. So I think that's something to keep in mind about the power of archaeology and showing people the different sites that exist in the land of Palestine. The one thing I wanted to add to this bit is the work I do in community archaeology. I know we didn't have a chance to talk about it, but it is that idea of the people of Palestine being involved in the archaeological enterprise in Palestine, mm-hmm. being involved in not only as workers, which they were in the past, bring them to shovel dirt, basically, but now being involved in the process, in the intellectual process, in the research process, and also understanding that, yeah, we have PhDs in archaeology and we know archaeology, but these people have knowledge. They've lived near these sites for many, many years. Their ancestors have lived there. So their contribution to our knowledge about the site is of paramount importance. And I feel that that's the new trajectory at the moment in Palestine. And I hope we can keep that momentum of community archaeology going.
Well, that's a very, very upbeat and optimistic note to end on. I wish I could ask you both what's going to be discovered next. we'll get very excited. But look, I'd like to thank you both, our wonderful guests this evening, Dr. Hamdan Taha and Dr. Iman Saka. Thank you so much for joining us from Ramallah, from Chicago, and from me in Buckingham. Not such an interesting
archaeological site. Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
But thank you very much. And thank you to all of you who have joined from actually all over the world. Great to have you joining us. Great to have your questions. I'm sorry we didn't get all of them in, but we did our best. And also thank you to Omar, to Alex, to Ahmed for all the work to make this show the great success that it is. And that success is down to our fantastic guests. Good luck with all that you do. And we'd love to see you again. Thank you very much indeed.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.